here are is the rest of the crew. So I will save these rantings for later.
I was enjoying them.
Well,
let you continue them, Vosh.
Good to see you.
Well, I'll be first to say that I, too, think the war with Iran is a bad idea. I don't know how many people here would agree with me on that, but I...
Hot take.
Controversial opinion. Hot take on this stream, yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for having us. Soypil, how you doing?
Thank you for doing it, Vosh. I'll just go quickly through the introductions here, and Vosh and Soypil let you guys take it over and sort of handle the overall moderation. But this panel, we've got a whole bunch of fantastic candidates for Senate. So I'll start with our two moderators here. Vosh, you guys probably already know him, but he's a YouTube political streamer known for, it says, debate-centered content. I like the way that's described, covering political philosophy, internet culture, and progressive of policy issues. Soypil is here as well, online political commentator associated with live stream discussion communities and internet political analysis. Abdul Al-Sayed is going to be joining us here just momentarily, but we also have Karishma Mansour. She's a medical scientist, progressive activist. She is running for Senate in New Hampshire. We have Julie Gonzalez. She's a Colorado state senator representing Denver, who has worked on immigration reform and workers' rights legislation, now running for U.S. Senate. And Angie Nixon, who is a Florida state representative and labor organizer advocating for voting rights, education, funding, and economic justice policies, running for Senate in Florida. And I'll go ahead, Abdul, looks like he might be having a little bit of trouble with his camera, but he is a public health expert, former Michigan gubernatorial candidate who is running for U.S. Senate, championing a progressive platform with a spotlight on Medicare for all, and is also at the center of a major astroturfed controversy around affiliating with Hassan Piker. Mm-hmm. So with all of that being said, Vosh and Soypil, I'll let you guys take it away with this conversation. And one more time, I will plug progress.win/rally. I know we've raised already $22,000 plus for the candidates on this stream. So thank you to everybody out there who has donated. If you can give, I'm telling you, it makes a huge difference because these are all candidates who are not going to have the multi-million dollar, you know, AI packs and APACs and crypto packs and all of that behind them. So they really, really count on you if you can give. So.
And remember, none of the money goes to me or Vosh. It's all for the candidates. If that makes you want to donate.
Don't make
more.
People suspicious of that claim. No, it's true. To my knowledge, APAC is funding none of the people here. So, you know, we have to make up for that somehow. Zero.
That's but APAC, if you're listening, I can't promise I'll change any opinions, but, you know, my email's open.
Yeah, we're open to a bid. No. It's incredible. I mean, Emma just filled us in on the way out there. I mean, apparently we're preparing for limited ground operations over there in Iran. I'd like to open, if I may, you know, because she talks for a little bit about the myth that Americans don't vote on foreign policy. Some foreign policy touches on our lives more concretely than others, right? America felt the Iraq war. There's plenty of things that America's done in the past 30 years. Abroad that the average American hasn't felt. Israel and its relationship to the United States has been a deeply felt element of American government for the past couple of years. This is just a fact. I think that a careful examination of Israel and their behavior and their relationship to their neighboring states would give one plenty of reasons to disagree with them on moral grounds, but I want to speak only politically for just a moment. Every American now is aware of this dynamic, this idea that we are unnecessarily beholden to Israel, to its weapons, to its funding, to its relationship with its neighbors, that we have to fight its wars. It is, at the very least, a perception that at this point everyone has come across. It is a fact that more people over time have shifted, especially Democrats, especially young Democrats, have shifted towards an anti-Israel position. The shift from being tepidly supportive of Israel to being very against their behavior in the Middle East has happened so quickly that I think a lot of Democratic politicians haven't caught up to it. There's been a whiplash effect. They don't know what's going on. But it is a fact that there are many young people today for whom, like Israeli or Netanyahu, they use them almost as synonyms for bad. This is just a fact. If you go online, you will see plenty of young people who say, oh, that's so Israeli. And they mean like a TV show they didn't like. That is the extent to which this discourse has permeated common culture. the fact that the Democratic Party hasn't woken up to this and addressed the fact that their constituency has shifted in its position is insane. It is politically, it is not just politically unviable, it's madness. It's counterintuitive. You would expect at the very least some kind of tepid acknowledgement that a change in the relationship between us and Israel is needed, or at the very least a reconciliation with the party. But if anything, the past year has shown us the Democrats are not, in many cases, willing to budge. There is a conservative faction within the Democratic Party that is using this as a litmus test. I think, I mean, certainly Abdul, who's with us today, thank you very much for being here, has faced the blunt end of this just in the past week. The idea that criticism of Israel is something that can be used to castigate you, even when the majority of your constituents agree with it. I think that's insane. I think that any sensible politician should be able to agree it's insane, even without touching on the morals. And I really don't know how the Democratic Party can survive, can win in the future, unless it's willing to reconcile with this. That's my opening bit. I just wanted to make it clear. I know that all of us agree, end the genocide, right? Free the Palestinian people. I know that we're on board with that. But also, man, on a political level, we are off. You know, it's crazy.
And Vosh, if I can jump in here, I'm sorry for the screen issues, but
not at all.
I think you hit the nail on the head. If this is not a legitimate space for conversation about where our tax dollars go in the aftermath of having subsidized a genocide and now getting pulled into an absolutely insane war in Iran because Netanyahu finally found an American president stupid enough to take us there, then I don't know what is. Now, it's absolutely critical for us to differentiate consistently, constantly, and clearly between Israel and AIPAC and the Jewish people and Judaism. Those are different things. And we need to, in the same breath, love and embrace the Jewish people and constantly decry anti-Semitism. And also, because of our love for people, recognize that we decry anti-Semitism and love the Jewish people, and also need to decry any form of genocide and apartheid being committed by a foreign government, particularly one that has taken our tax dollars. And so we can say all of those things in one breath. In fact, we have to if we're serious about our foundational ideals and we lead with those. So, you know, I just think it's important for us to hold space, to keep saying what we believe about the state of Israel and about AIPAC, which is a MAGA-funded super PAC trying, or set of super PACs, trying to move our foreign policy in lockstep with Israel, and at the same time recognize that that has nothing to do with loving and embracing Judaism and the Jewish people.
Yeah, Abdul, I want to piggyback off of that, because it's crazy that you and us have to make that distinction, because the people that conflate anti-Zionism or Israel criticism are the ones who's actually spreading anti-Semitism in a way, the same phenomenon that Vosh was talking about, where you see all these people using Israel and Netanyahu as bad. Those people don't see that distinction. And those people hear the people defending Israel and saying, oh, you're anti-Semitic if you criticize their policy. And they say, well, I guess I am anti-Semitic because I don't like what Israel is doing. I don't like what Netanyahu is doing. And this same phenomenon of anti-Israel, Instagram memes and TikToks and spreading throughout the youth, that's turning into anti-Semitism. And, you know, as a Jewish person, I'm getting a little nervous. I can't lie. Like, I'm like, whoa, geez, like some of these don't seem like jokes anymore. So it is important for us to make that distinction. And it's insane that we are the ones who have to do that.
I
just wanted to say that sort of distinction, it's being, my opponent is Chris Pappas, and he was asked recently, like, how come you have taken $2.7 million from AIPAC? And these were the town chairs here in New Hampshire. His answer was, these are not from AIPAC, these are from Jewish donors. So they are... Even these politicians are throwing Jewish people under the bus, because we know AIPAC donors are not necessarily Jewish folks. These might be weapons manufacturers. These might be CUFI. There's another organization that we actually don't mention enough, the Christians United for Israel. They are a really dangerous organization. Those are mostly evangelical Christians. So for them, when they see the death and destruction across the Middle East, they're not looking at it as something morally reprehensible. They are thinking of collateral damage, because this is where the rapture is going to happen and Jesus Christ is going to come back. Yeah, so CUFI is a really dangerous organization. But that sort of distinction between Jewish folks as well as AIPAC donors, that merger is being perpetrated by by these politicians, these genocide enablers. So this is extremely dangerous. So thank you for Soy for mentioning it, and thank you for Abdul for bringing this up.
Yeah, and I want to piggyback off the thing I came here to say. You talk about like witnessing the death and destruction, and I think often, I mean, this whole thing, it's anti-war. Everyone here is anti-war. Most people are anti-war. And the problem with that is you get kind of numb. You just hear war. War is bad. You hear a stat, 10,000 people died, 60,000 Palestinians dead, and you become very removed from what this is. And so maybe this is something that has worked for me. And I ask if anyone supports the war, you have family members that support it, you have Trump, you know, relatives or friends, show them like the anecdotes, like, because these stats sometimes are lost on people. Show them a mother watching her child be shredded by a bomb. And I know that's like you're saying, hey, no one wants to see that. That's morbid. That's visceral. But that's what war is. And so there's a reason we oppose this. And we kind of get lost in the rhetoric of it before we see, oh, these are the direct consequences. Imagine you have a daughter that you raised for 12 years, and that's erased in 10 seconds because of some stupid fucking policy from our current government. Like, you really need to face that and realize that if you want to justify this, you need a damn good reason, because that is not something that is okay. And the second point that I wanted to bring up is there are wars in the past that we've justified. World War II is the one everyone always brings up, and you can make arguments for other ones, but there's a world in which you could say, hey, if there was a nuclear country that was willing to use that the instant it happened, you could potentially get someone like me to say, you know what, maybe we do need to start a war, face the awful consequences of that to stop something worse from happening. But the problem is, and Kyle was so kind as to make that list of like 10 reasons maybe why Trump is doing this, not a singular one of those was, hey, because they might nuclearize. It's insane because, one, you know, you have to look at Iraq and say, okay, they lied about this in the past. How are we supposed to trust you now? But two, there is a million things you can do in between bombing innocent people to stop a nuclear war or to stop a country from getting nukes, one of which was the nuclear deal, which Republicans were so ready to completely dismantle, despite the, you know, international community saying, hey, this is good. They're following the regulations. They're following the check-ins. And so you look at this and they say, well, this is the only option. Well, it's not. There was negotiations. There were sanctions. There were so many things we could do in between here. And Republicans are so quick, as is their playbook, to tear this down completely and then say, well, you forced our hand. Now we have to go to war and kill innocent people. And that's just not the case. It's the same thing with USAID. You know, well, maybe we'll need some leverage in Sudan. Well, guess what? Now they're not really so ready to have any leverage with us because we killed millions of their people. You know, it's very frustrating to watch just how Republicans have handled this.
The reason that this is happening is because it's profitable. I think that's really important to just really highlight. It's making folks money, the folks who are at the top, as well as Donald Trump and his family and his friends and his campaign donors and all those folks. And so war is profitable. And what we have to remind people of is that it doesn't have to be this way at all. We can actually start electing hardworking, everyday people, and things would change. Like, I am a union organizer. I am a community organizer. I've been a state lawmaker here in the state of Florida, ground zero for everything bad, right? So you all know that many of the bills that come out of our state legislature, they cross the country and they go into other state legislatures, and they're also federalized on a federal level. And so I come from the school of feeling as though hardworking people should get to shape what their economies and their communities look like. Right now, that's not happening. And so it is going to be up to us, right? And the people to realize that no one politician is going to save us, right? There's two types of power. There's organized people and there's organized money. And right now, organized money is winning, and that's because the people aren't organized. We keep allowing them to divide us in regards to Blacks and Hispanics and Latinos and all these things, right? And that is profitable. Again, like, division is so profitable because it keeps us off of looking at them pushing these bad policies. But again, like, when it comes down to war at the end of the day, like, I've seen numbers that Donald Trump has gotten richer. His friends and his family, every time he says something or whatever, like, the stock market goes up and it goes down. And it's like, that is intentional. And we have to change the architects right now, which are these
horrible, corrupt politicians, right? If we want to see something different. And I think that's why all of us are running here on this, not a Zoom, on the stream.
And I agree with you. Sorry, Julie, go for it.
Totally. No, I'll just jump in and say, one, I'm hoarse just because I came back from our No Kings rally. And immediately before that, we had our state assembly. And your girl just took top line and will be in a head-to-head with John Hickenlooper, a go-along-to-get-along Democrat who has done absolutely nothing to fight for working people to stand up to the Trump administration. But what I will say is that to this conversation, right, when it is in this moment, there is, for so many politicians, it is easier to say nothing than to put forward a critique of this administration, of Israel's policies of entering into this war. But when you look, I come at this work as an immigrant rights organizer. And when you look at what were the conditions of the United States intervention in so many countries across Latin America a generation ago that then led to the destabilization that then created the conditions for immigration. And then you look at globalization and I grew up on the border of deep South Texas way back in 1993, 1994, NAFTA is enacted. And you then see that goods and services get to cross borders freely, but people did not get that same respect. And now when you look full circle a generation later, and who is profiting, just as Angie is saying, right? It is defense contractors. But who is going to pay the price? If not Americans with our lives, it will be us who pay the price at the gas pump, at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And it begs the question, right? When we're in a moment where it becomes fraught to even just say anything, what are we doing as a society? Exactly. Right. And it's so lovely to be here in this room with y'all to be able to have these conversations, because nobody ain't coming to save us but us. We're the ones that we've been waiting for.
If I can jump in on Please. That, I really appreciate both of those points. You know, the other side of it is this. It's not like we don't have problems here. I've been up and down my state, 90 different cities now, and every room I walk out, I can't afford to take my kid to a doctor. I can't afford to fill up my whole tank of gas. I don't know how I'm going to pay my rent. I can't ever afford a home. I am stuck in debt after debt after debt, credit card debt on top of student loan debt, on top of housing debt. And I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do next. And the reality of it is every dollar that we spend dropping a bomb on somebody else, every dollar we spend destroying a hospital or destroying a school is a dollar we're not spending actually solving problems here at home. And the thing about it is this, like, you don't have to go very far and you don't have to say very much for people to understand that there's an opportunity cost for the dollars that we are wasting abroad. $22 billion to subsidize a genocide sent to a foreign military. You're talking about $1 billion a day in this war. I don't know anybody who pays their taxes in April and says, you know what, I can't wait to buy another country a tank or a bomb. And so we've got to remind people that really, at the end of the day, like, we are the actual America First Party, right? But we actually want you to benefit, not our corporations to benefit at the end of the day.
Yeah. And so, Soipil, you mentioned a good point. Like, how do you connect with folks? And so Abdul and Angie and Julie made all these great points, like talking about the economic costs. And this is sometimes, unfortunately, when people hear 300,000 Gazans died and you see you're not moving the needle, you're like, okay, let's try a different strategy, right? And so, of course, the economic cost is really working with a lot of folks. People don't want to know that they're paying taxes and it's not coming back to their communities, it's going to war. The other is, unfortunately, which is terrible, is the fact that 13 service members were killed in the last 4 weeks. So a lot of times I lead with that. If I say 1,000 Iranians died, it might just be another number. 1,000 Lebanese died, again, just another number. And given that we know that all these death and destruction of Gaza didn't move the needle, I always say 13 service members died. How many more service members are we willing to sacrifice at the altar of Netanyahu, a war criminal? And so that's exactly what we have to do. And also, like the other panelists mentioned, talk about the economic costs. And just like what we're seeing in Michigan, what Abdul just said, here in New Hampshire, homelessness crisis is really at an all-time high. And now, of course, it's been also criminalized to be homeless. So you can't even be in a camp. They're just shoving people around from one side to the other. A lot of these people have jobs. They just can't even afford to rent an apartment.
Yeah, I want to say the reason you know the whole troops as an effective strategy works is because for so long the Trump admin's defense was no boots on the ground, it's only air. And now that they're apparently, as per this recent news, going to be sending thousands more people and we might be doing ground operations, it sucks that you can't say, hey, look, you know, 1,000 brown people died, don't you care? And the answer sometimes is no. But these are, you know, service members. It's very prevalent in the Republican Party to have family members in there. And you can weaponize their like extreme dogmatic support of the military to say, hey, do you want your children dying for this senseless war where the administration can't even give a straight reason? That is a very effective strategy.
I'd like to jump on that too.
And because... look at what the numbers from the Iraq war. Again, the Iraq war, Iraq was much smaller country, but just look at the numbers, and you most probably all of you know about it. But over 500,000 Iraqis and Syrians died in that Iraq war. Remember, it was going to be quick. We were going to be welcomed as liberators. It was going to be cheap. None of that happened. It lasted, 8 years? It resulted in the deaths of over 500,000 Iraqis and Syrians. That's a conservative estimate. Some people say it's over 1 million. And if you just look at the numbers of service members, 4,492 U.S. service members died in that war. And over 30,000 U.S. service members came home with either a mental trauma or a physical trauma. And over the course of the last 25 years, over this whole war on terror, we have lost over 5,000 service members to suicide per year. So I always lead with, what are we doing to our own troops? You may not care about those brown people overseas, but do you at least care about these, our own troops who have, what did they sign up for? National security. They didn't sign up for Benjamin Netanyahu's wars. They didn't sign up to enrich another weapons manufacturers. So that's what I lead with. And right now, because thank you, and I do see, I think Casey's here, I wanted to do a shout out to Track AIPAC. Amazing group, what you guys have done. People understand AIPAC now. I was at a nursing home, and 60-year-old or 70-year-olds, I don't know how old they were like, and how, AIPAC, do you take money from AIPAC? I'm like, yes, we've done it. If nursing home folks are asking me about AIPAC money, then, you know, Track AIPAC has done its job. So shout out to all of you. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. I'd like to jump in and add one more thing to that point, which is that, you know, I don't expect the policies that
Am I the only person that doesn't hear Vosh?
I guess I can hear.
Oh, okay.
Oh, dang.
Can
you hear?
It's because I just entered. I was coming in to do the moderator.
It's
thing,
good to
so
know
I'll
somebody
go
can.
Off.
I'm happy to hear some people can. No,
I'll raise my hand when he's done, Emma.
I just wanted to say,
can't hear him.
I think that it's very dangerous when people lose faith in the idea that the politicians represent what they want. We know politicians don't. There's not a perfect relationship between what politicians support and what their constituency wants. It'll never be a perfect relationship. But the idea that there is such a disconnect that there's no longer even a point to petition your politician, that's where you get a fundamental breakdown. That's like a civil society failure. Yeah, on sure. Most issues, I think that Democratic politicians are at least open to a conversation. Not all, right? People vary, you know? But sometimes when I see the way the discourse over supporting Israel plays out, especially in news media, the way people like, say, Zoran Mamdani, you know, they had it held over their head as a litmus test. Every debate, every conversation with media people, always and always, you know, it got brought up. It makes me think that there's no room for conversation. And if there's no room, if people can't even talk about it, then literally what's the point? No subject should be off the table when it comes to an open dialogue between politicians and their constituencies.
But Vosh, Vosh, the thing is, that is kind of where we are right now. But again, like I stated, it doesn't have to be that way. It says a lot that I have a husband, right? And he's saying that, him saying to me that the Democrats and the Republicans are different wings on the same bird. that means we have failed, right? That means we have allowed corporate Democrats to lead our party. And that means that we have to change that, right? And so we cannot continue to elect people who are basically okay with getting scraps, and they're too afraid to speak up and push back because they're worried about their appropriations being cut. Meanwhile, or they're worrying about their bills passing or not passing, right? Meanwhile, they're not even allowing them to pass anything transformative. And I'm speaking from being in a super minority, right? Like, if we are in a super minority, like we are in the state of Florida, we need to be the party of like resistance. We need to let people know that we are here fighting to uplift their lives, right? And what's very interesting to me is that what frustrates me sometimes about our party is that when Obama was in office, right, whether or not you love him or not, he was cool with me, but when he was in office, the Tea Party movement started happening. And even when they were in the minority and in some super minorities, they always like pushed back and fought hard. There was no compromise, right? And yes, I understand us as Democrats, we need to compromise, but like we cannot compromise our values because our values have compromised people's lives. We see it playing out in what's happening over in Gaza. We see it playing out right now, what Abdul stated, like people are dying here in America because they can't afford their medication. They are dying because they can't afford a roof over their home. There was a woman whose children died in a car. They froze to death. What the fuck? Right? I literally had a call with my friend the other day. She is fearful if she lose her job because she just came out of the hospital. She doesn't know what is going to happen. There is so many people that are living their lives like that. Not only that, but when you think about it, I am a Black woman, so I am going to speak from a Black lived experience. Over 600,000 Black men have lost their jobs in a matter of months. Over 500,000 Black women. We should be upset and pissed off. But we have, and I want to say, Brother Abdul, they're spending $2 billion a day. $2 billion a day to bomb people. But they want to tell us they ain't got money to feed our children breakfast at schools. They don't want to expand ACA. Get out of here with that. If you want different, everyone that's watching us on this stream, then you need to make sure that not only do you vote differently, but like we are outspent, right? We are outraised on this call. And so we need you to tell a friend and tell a friend and tell a friend. All of you all need to donate to these folks that are on this call because these establishment Dems, they want to keep the status quo as well. And so if we want different, we will do different.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. It's about building a stronger opposition to the fascist forces. And that's like what this is about. This is not criticism or for criticism's sake. This is about building a stronger party that really represents working people and their actual struggles. So I want to thank this panel so much for all of your contributions. Of course, everybody on here support campaigns. You can go to, of course, progress.win/rally to support this general stream, but everybody check out all of the candidates and creators on this stream right now. I still don't know if I can hear Vosh, but gotta say goodbye to everybody at once, and then we will bring on our next panelists for our final panel. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thanks, y'all. Okay,
yeah. Sorry, Vosh, I couldn't hear you. I apparently cut you off.
No worries. It was very funny. I don't know if you can hear me.
We just cut you guys off. So.
Thank you.
Anyways, yeah. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, right. So Vosh is talking. You're talking. I can't figure it out. This must be a Discord problem. Or it's
a stream. He's saying really nasty things.
It's okay. It's my. I don't know. I'm communicating non-verbally that I feel good.
Job of faking me out.
It's Discord. I'm not muted.
Next up.